Jam. Hello and welcome to a very Christmassy episode of Dynamite Neddy. It's the Retro Games Podcast on Christmas, where a couple of old pals get together and talk about a couple of old Christmas games. The voice you're hearing just now is myself, Mick Clockerty. Joining me as always, we have Mr. Mick McCormick.
You're a mean one, Mr. Mick.
And we have Mr. Andy Mack.
Merry Creechuanus, cuntos.
Aye, not like Creole boys, and happy new year when it comes. How yous feeling? Are yous in the spirit?
Not yet. It doesn't really feel like it's Christmas, to be honest. This one's flew in, the whole lead up. I've not even watched Arnie yet or nothing.
Arnie? Is this a Christmas tradition for you?
Aye, I fucking love Jingle All the Way. It's turbo time.
Andy, this is actually very useful of you. I'm trying to think off the top of my head if I've got a Christmas tradition film.
I've been leaning towards Gremlins recently.
Gremlins is good. It was good when we went to go and see it at the Pictures at the Green Oak Cinema last year.
There's another one too. I used to watch a TV movie. It was a rip-off of Groundhog Day. I can't remember what it was called, but it's basically Christmas. It might actually be called Christmas Every Day.
Andy, do you think this might have been the Ross Kemp Christmas Carol?
No, I love that and all.
That is also a rip-off of Groundhog Day. Scrooge relives Christmas three times, but each time with a different ghost.
Oh, no, this one's American, and his family comes to his house for Christmas 3 days in a row. And then the last day, he just goes, fuck it, like Groundhog Day, essentially.
Aye.
That's good, man. It was a good film, I thought, but looking back on it, it rose to its specs. But, I mean, what is a Christmas film? I mean, I heard the definition of a Christmas film was, if there's snow in it, it can be a Christmas film. I don't agree with that. That makes a thing a Christmas film.
I'm just going to put a ban on the basic bitch diehard chat, because I think that, I don't want to stoop to that. I think as a podcast, we're above such conversations.
Mick, this is a similar thing happened at that beer festival. It was after you already left, where I was probably already a few drinks in at this point, and I feel like it was quite nasty. I pissed on Andy's bonfire a bit. He said to me, oh, Mick, what do you think? Is Die Hard a Christmas film? And I went, I don't care.
Aye. That's the thing. I mean, Christmas film is just something that you enjoy at Christmas, isn't it? That should be a definition. It could be a series as well.
Have you seen those kind of memes? It's like three sets of three, and it's like, for example, like a Christmas film would be like if the content is really important, or if like the kind of vibe is really important, and then it's like how much you, based on how much you care about it, defines like what is and what wouldn't be a Christmas film.
Like a Venn diagram. Aye.
Kind of. So like, do you care that it's set on Christmas Day, or do you care that it's like, it's got the kind of the feelings of goodwill to all men and all that? Like,
Sometimes it's an old VHS I got for my Christmas.
Yep, I would say that's a shout. Right, settle in. I've got a wee story for you, right?
Right.
Do you want to hear about the first time I didn't go to Mass on Christmas?
Oh, aye.
Right. No, pretty much nobody in my household goes to Mass even on Christmas Day, right? My old man will still go, and I'll chum him now. I've kind of come full circle to going back at Christmas because I feel bad. But I was in my early 20s, and I was talking to Matt, who the eagle-eared listener may remember from our Disney special. We played all the Disney Sega games. A pal of mine that works in animation, immigrated to Canada, good friend of the show. He was telling me that he had stopped going to Mass on Christmas, and he was basically extolling the virtues. He was talking about how you have a really good Christmas if you don't go to Mass. And this stuck in the back of my head. I had done the usual. I was out in the Jimmy Watt Christmas Eve, hungover on Christmas morning, as you do. Woke up, lovely family time, everybody's, you know, exchanging gifts or whatever. And when it came time to go to chapel, because my family are Christmas Day chapel people, historically, not the vigil Mass on Christmas Eve. They were all going to Mass, and I said, no, I'm putting my foot down.
Oh.
I'm not going. You don't need to go without me. you know, and there was some glances exchanged, but it was, you know, what are they going to do? They're not going to drag you at gunpoint.
He's up, Roddy, kick him out.
So they all went to chapel, and I ate a couple of things at the selection box, drank a couple of hair of the dog beers, sat in front of the fire, and then Braveheart was on a telly, and I just thought, what bliss. So Braveheart is kind of a Christmas film to me.
Ah, that makes sense.
William Wallace never missed Mass on Christmas Day. What are you talking about?
No. Did they get your head cut off back then if you did?
Well, not according to Mel Gibson, who would probably be keen to stress how Catholic everybody was back then.
I think you're right. I think you've fucking nailed the head. I think it's sentimental. It's something you've done, perhaps with family or yourself, at Christmas time, that you've got good memories and gave you a good feeling at some time. So, aye, that's what Christmas is all about.
We're leading on the Christmas bit of this a lot. We've not really got so much into the Hogmanay side of things yet. Tell me, are yous Hogmanay fans?
I used to be, man. I've got like two sections on Hogmanay memories. I've got once I went back where it was fucking dino because you got to stay up by 12 o'clock.
Aye, only an excuse is on. Aye, do you know what I mean? You stay up late. Aye.
For the telly.
And then sometimes my father would give me a lager shandy. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'd be like, oh, yeah, man, I'm up here. I'm up, I'm drinking at fucking 12 o'clock and I'm only fucking 10. You know what I mean?
I've got getting given alcohol at an appropriately young age as well. Yep, baby. Aye. Sham. What's that fucking other thing? A snowball. I remember getting given a snowball.
Aye, it was just shandy for me, but apparently in Scotland you're allowed to drink at 7 and we only used Hogmanay. So, aye, but that's what my memory. My second set of memories is...
Sorry, I just get this notion in my head that Hogmanay is kind of like the Purge.
It kind of is.
In concept.
The legal system just reverts back to the year like 1250 or something. I don't have a whole lot of amazing Hogmanay memories. Like, there was a kind of brief window, I feel, where I was like old enough to drink and go with my pals. And also stayed in Greenock and had enough folk that like lived nearby, they could throw a big house party in Hogmanay.
Aye.
That seemed to end like a few years ago, and I've kind of not had any decent Hogmanay party. Well, I've had the odd good Hogmanay party in Glasgow, but it's not a yearly occurrence.
What was the one I was at with you, McCormick, about 10 years ago or something? I remember being at one. There were a couple, actually. I think I went one with you maybe 15, dare say it, maybe even 20 years ago. Most of the 20 probably, when we went away doing One's Bay or Undercap. I can't remember what one it was.
Somebody's, I don't want to dox anyone unwillingly here. So
somebody's
just...
big huge gaff, man.
The strangest Hogmanay I ever had was with McCormick, and it was in the Navy Club, which I think you've got an uncle that's a member or something, Mick.
I can't remember. It was something, somehow I got invited through my dad. I don't know how. Maybe it was one of his pals.
It wasn't a BYOB. I'd never seen this done before. It was bring your own food, and different tables had all brought different sort of their own scrans in, like a kind of spread. It was very strange.
Some sort of old military tradition.
The weirdest one I had was with a certain respectable gentleman that I used to run about with, and he was kicked out his house. So, showing a bit of solidarity with him, I said, I'll stay out with you, man, I'll stay out with you. So we went and stayed behind the Marner's home, you know where the biscuit is?
Yes.
And
unfortunately,
I suppose he was showing.
Can I just fucking drop that?
So I suppose he was feeling a bit charitable because I was kind of answering the call to his plight and getting him some company. So he told me I was sleeping just on the dirt, and he said he'd go and get me a pillow, right? So he appears back maybe 15 minutes later with two doormats, right?
Yes.
Now I was thinking, fuck it, all day, you know, we'll put them back in the morning, you know? But he got his two plastic ones. So, it was even more uncomfortable, but I suppose the thought was there, you know, and I did appreciate it.
Andy, I'm not letting this go, right? What is the biscuit? I know what the biscuit is, but none of our audience do, I can guarantee you.
I was waiting for what the key bit of nonsense is in the intro to this, and it's this, it's what is the biscuit. Sorry, Andy, please continue.
We've got a beautiful big building called the Mariner's Home here. It was an old folks' home for retired mariners that get things of dementia and whatever.
Korsakoff's.
Aye. That's the thing with drinking, isn't it?
It's when you cane it so hard, you're such a big drinker, as a lot of seafaring men were, that when you're old and you stop drinking, you don't have a short-term memory anymore, man. Like Memento, exact same thing.
Right, okay.
It just destroys your short-term memory.
That's all them rum rations, isn't it?
I had among other things.
Aye. Well, do you ever hear about the Soviet Navy guy that he used to kill...
No, stick to the biscuit.
Right, so anyways, the biscuit, right, so it's behind this big building. And we used to, when we were younger, fucking wean heads, essentially, we used to drink up there. There was this one where, there's this bit of it where it was like a huge big circle of concrete, randomly in the middle of a forest. And you could all stand around it and kind of look at each other and drink. And it was just like, it was a weird kind of social scenario, but it worked. And it was at the top of a big fucking air raid shelter for the 1930s, 1940s. And apparently it was down about 50 feet. I've never ever went down it, but apparently there's a way to get in it. I'd quite like to do that. It's a bucket list scenario.
Aye.
I was watching that TV show Fringe with my girlfriend a couple of days ago, and there's a bit where one of the characters says there's certain points on this earth where the barrier between universes is very thin and the normal laws of physics don't apply, and I just burst out of nowhere like the biscuit.
Aye.
That's one of them places.
It definitely does feel like one of those places.
So the thing is, like, you know how, like, if you've got a bunch of mates that have not been to Green Oak Guard, a couple of guys that have not been to Green Oak for ages, or you've not seen somebody in ages, and they say, and they think, where do you want to go? Like, some people might say, Jimmy Watt, some people might say, I don't know, fishing over the point. I think I'm going to fucking biscuit.
Aye. No? I mean, that's kind of your equivalent of, like, the Cross of Lorraine or something, isn't it?
An old stomping ground. Aye, if you're going to maybe grab a bottle and get a biscuit, there's busties. Get one of these speakers that you used to get for the Sony Ericsson phones. Pull some DJ Rankin. With a Casper Cha-Cha slide or something, you know, and get pissed.
Get some old Mariners thinking you're the Japanese back to get them or something like that. Freak everybody out. The war criminals, am I right, Andy?
Ah, I've said nothing.
Oh, that was me trying to get another box ticked there.
I'm surprised my granddad wasn't there. I'm sure he used to claim that his fucking appendix scar was when the Japanese got him.
But yes, boys, I suppose we will get into our festive lists. The reason for the season, the eagle-eared listener will know by now that around this time of year, for our last episode of the year, what we like to do is to grab our Christmas dinner plate and pick out three roast totties, which would be our favourite three games that we played this year on Dynamite Neddy, and one Brussels sprout, and this would be your least favourite game of the year. That's your conceit here, and I like to start with a couple of roasties and then do the sprout just before our kind of final roastie. As I have been doing on these kind of round tables, I'm going to pick on Mr. McCormick and ask you to come in with your first roastie of the year. Now, you can do these in no particular order. If you find it hard to separate the games, you don't have to do like a bronze, silver, gold. Or you can do that if you want.
So my first pick is the high-speed heavy metal rocker that is F-Zero X.
Cracker.
On the N64. This is a surprise hit for me. Racing games aren't always my forte. This one in particular was a bit of a slow burner because I wasn't very good at it to start with and I didn't really see the appeal. And then there was just a kind of Road to Damascus moment where it clicked for me.
It's got something about it. I like
an F-Zero X-Factor.
Aye, it's got the F-Zero X-Factor. I personally always like how busy the track is. I like that there's so many other crafts speeding about, and that this doesn't slow the game down. It really... Andy, I'm sorry to slate something that you love. It feels like what pod racing should feel like, I think. it's like a mad outer space race.
Good point.
It's got a kind of cyberpunk vibe to it. It's just... It's good crack. You can't fault F-Zero X on the list, I don't think.
It's one of the games that get better the minute you play it.
There was things in it that I was kind of seeing as flaws, which I then realised were actually key parts of the experience. Like the pure chaos of it. Like the fact that like maybe fucking 64 racers will start and only 4 will finish.
Like, yeah, I like that these are... Okay, there's not a lot of story in it, but you get a lot of... wee blurbs for these characters, and a lot of them tend to be these kind of shady cunts, you know, they're all like space pirates and stuff, you know, living by the sword and racing in these really fucking dangerous...
And the music is like what you would imagine them listening to in the studio.
And driving through a cow pole, you kind of beat it.
Exactly. Yeah, I would thoroughly recommend that one to any racing game fans, but also anyone lonely enough that they don't have any pals to play their racing games with, unfortunately.
Yeah, this is the big failing of F-Zero X, is that it was a single player game.
Weird, strange.
But it's for technical reasons. Like, yeah. You just couldn't get... They wanted to make a game that ran at 60 FPS, and if that meant you can only play it as one player, then you were playing it as one player.
Aye.
Unfortunately. I mean, if they remade it or something, then, you know, they probably could have it running, you know, as many players as possible. They did, like, a Battle Royale F-Zero game where you get all the hundreds and hundreds of racers. I've not tried it, but it sounds pretty good. That was one of these, like, Lethal Heaven things. It was, like, announced, like, the second after we finished recording this episode.
Aye.
One of the things that's made Nintendo stand out about that time was their ability to convert their 2D games into polygonal 3D games. Mario Kart, seamless. Mario 64, seamless to an extent. And F-Zero X being another example, unlike Sega, who couldn't even get their fucking flagship.
No,
it's a good point, actually. Like, I think in Nintendo, or maybe like Miyamoto in particular, just he has this idea of like, what is the essence of this game? Like, if you understand the essence of the game, then you can play it probably with like black and white, like 4 pixels, or you can play it with like 4K. 120 FPS 3D.
Arguably, they got better. Everything that was on the SNES, you could argue that the N64 version was better in every way. I know there are some people who would claim Super Mario World is a more complete game than Mario 64, or A Link to the Past beats out Ocarina of Time.
Aye,
but when I think of things like F-Zero X, that's better than F-Zero. Mario Kart 64, that's better than Mario Kart SNES. Lilac Wars, better than Star Wing. They generally were hit after hit.
With the Mode 7 games, you were controlling the screen and not the character, and it kind of took away from your gameplay compared to these 3D ones.
Aye.
Pretty good, man.
No, I'll give you that, McCormick. Good first pick to come in with. Mr. MacArthur, why don't you come in and engage your first roasty?
Alright, so first roasty this year, I had a kind of lukewarm list this year compared to likes of you guys who had big hitters.
I think you had some pretty good games this year.
I'm embezzling it a bit. I don't know. Maybe this is just the way I'm looking at it. But I'm going to go for my first one, Evo: The Search of Eden.
This was the evolution simulator game. Tell us a wee bit about it. Refresh my memory.
So Evo: The Search of Eden was an action-adventure game whereby you would start off as a sort of basic being, and you would, through RPG mechanics, upgrade your wee guy to become more evolved.
Aye.
And there was certain different scenarios through the game as well. Like, you would be a fish, then you would be a dinosaur, and then you would even become man himself. Or was that even fucking PC anime? I don't know. But the equivalent of becoming
Homo
man. Homo sapiens at the end. And backed by this weird kind of sci-fi story about aliens and shit, man. I really enjoyed it. It was a bit grindy, remember, killing the same enemy over and over again. But in fact, you could customise your character and put like big fucking stupid horns on yourself and wings and shit, and it would make you more powerful or whatever. I quite enjoyed that aspect of it, and it was lovely to look at
impressive.
As well.
How they managed to get like the sprite looking and moving well, despite the fact that you could have like any number of combinations of mad parts on it.
That was cool.
It's like quite impressive. And they all kind of look quite cute in that as well, even no matter what fucking monstrosity chimera you'd created.
If you saw Spore, which came out a long while after, and Promised the World, I think it might have been the known charlatan Peter Molyneux, perhaps, that was behind that one.
No, that was it was Mr. SimCity.
Oh, yes.
Well, right.
Spore, Promised the World, and actually, Disney did that much different than what was in Evo.
It's good. I like the fact that it was weird. You had to eat your way to evolution. But the thing is, you can evolve like your jaws, your horns, your necks, your body, tail, even your dorsal, whatever the fuck it is. we are power up points from eating things. Aye. So it was pretty cool. Also, I mentioned the way it looked, like there was all sorts going on here. It really pushed the SNES to its limit. Screen background's always dynamic, moving about at different speeds from other parts of it. They, on here, we called it the Citizen Kane effect at times.
Aye. It's got a charm to it, Andy. You also... It's got that David Dickinson thing that you like, where the cartridges of it sell for, like, hundreds of dollars.
That's always good. It's always good. I mean, there's quite a rare game as well, which I suppose adds to its mystery. And the fact that when I get a game on Neddy, I've usually heard the title at least. This aye. One came completely off the left field. I've never heard this game before, and that made it even more interesting.
No, that's always good, I agree. McCormick, I want you to put your teenage atheist hat back on. You know, imagine you're reading like Richard Dawkins and that, right? This game is called Evolution, but it seems to put forward intelligent design. Is that fair to say?
That is very true, yeah. Because not only is like Evolution guided by yourself, the player, in that you're expending resources to like upgrade your character. It's not evolutionary pressure that's kind of driving the evolution. But also like in terms of the story, Evolution on a macro scale has been guided by like some sort of alien anime woman.
She's like a Japanese mana goddess, like princess character.
Yeah, they basically turned it into a kind of good and evil battle where like certain types of creature are considered worthy, and that only those creatures, if they win the sort of survival of the fittest, then the evolution of Earth as a whole will move on to its kind of next stage. It's teleological is they call it. It's like directed, evolution is directed towards a kind of a final goal. And I find that most games, I don't know of any game really that makes evolution, like actual evolution as it works in the real world,
aye,
a captivating and interesting game mechanic, because it's a process that takes place over like millions of generations, whereas in most games there's some sort of element of a character that you follow like throughout the course of the game. So yeah, aye. I've always wondered what, like, for example, Pokemon would be like if it had actual Darwinian evolution. It'd be something very different.
I like some of the artistic licenses took with us. You know how sometimes in like films it'll be a bit historical, something historical or based in fact, but they'll use artistic license to put wee bits in. I like when you go back and you warn the king of the dinosaurs that the Chicxulub meteor's coming.
Aye.
And there's nothing you can do about it.
As if like that would have made any difference. Like...
I know. It's just created the disease anxiety.
Yeah, it's turning, like, I mean, that is just, like, the random cruelty of the universe that caused that to happen, but in a video game, you have to turn it into, like, a story with goodies and baddies.
Aye.
This is why you get ridiculous situations, like telling a dinosaur, the meteor's coming, like, no, you're talking shite.
My final word would probably be very interesting in the game, a wee classic, and it just shows the kind of things that were going on at this period when this game was made. This was when they were looking less at games being Pong or Defender, and more like being an all-rounded kind of merging genres like RPGs and platformers to create something truly unique.
It's an abstract idea for a game, isn't it?
Aye, pretty cool.
I think both me and Mick quite like giving you things sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes things are a bit experimental because you don't always click with them, but when you do, it's like magic. Like facades, for example.
Yeah, they will often end up on Andy's dinner plate, his Game of the Year list. You gave him something a wee bit weird, and if it gels with him, you know, it's a big hitter.
Aye, and I do like that. I mean, facade being the obvious case in point there. I mean, I love something different. I have an issue with playing games that are the same thing over and over again. First person shooters, right? Fucking aye. Same thing every fucking time, right?
No, I get that.
Right? FIFA, that's not FIFA. Same shite every time. Things like that, you know? GTA fucking clones. Sandbox games, they're just all the same.
They were a dime a dozen on the PS2, the GTA clones.
Aye. I have to tell you what, by the way, lads. Even them Bethesda games, I've just played Starfield there, and I'm all Bethesda out for a while. Because the sameness. Like games like The Witcher, Starfield and Fallout and all that all been the same thing essentially.
I've heard that Starfield is Skyrim in space with Fallout 4 elements. It seems like they're making the same stuff over and over again.
They need to mix it up, man. It's a great formula, but it's been done, do something different.
There always seems to be something with Bethesda games, but for a start, like, the technology is pretty out of date. They're always buggy as fuck when they come out, but like, they seem to have like a great vibe with like a really enticing world, and then when you scratch the surface a wee bit, you're like, oh, there's kind of nothing there.
Aye.
It's like the loot collecting thing. After a while, you're like, what's the point, man?
I think they might be a wee bit of a one-trick pony, and we've seen the trick, do you know what I mean?
Aye, could be.
But anyway, I'll come in and I'll give you my first roastie of the year. I'm going to go in. I don't know if any guestie picks have made it onto your boys' lists, but this is a guestie. Long-time listener, friend of the show, Mr. Johnny Branchfield, will be happy to know that Tales of Phantasia has made it onto my dinner plate.
Nice one.
This earned its place just for being a full package, really. You've got beautiful graphics. Soundtrack doesn't get old. I never once found the tunes annoying in this game. A battle system that stays engaging, which even some RPGs I love dearly, sometimes when you're playing a lot of fights, they just meld together. You know, you kind of zone out and you just mash the A button. I thought the battle system in Tales of Phantasia stayed really engaging, and just a cracker wee cast of characters to get invested in.
That's a very recent one.
It was the final game I played for the year, basically.
Aye.
So it could have been even higher up my list, I think, if emulation didn't kind of fuck me over. I would have kept playing this if I hadn't, for like the third time, lost a couple hours of like progress at that point.
Say, like, I know how frustrated and annoyed you get, raging. Aye. Even, I would say, you get when like technical difficulties kind of mar your enjoyment or something, and the fact that you've managed to persevere through that
says it all.
Says it all for Tales of Phantasia.
No, again, it was just a cracker wee game, particularly the Game Boy Advance version that Johnny put us onto. I had a look at some of the other versions, and I think the GBA one might look the best. And, you know, it's a system that's, I don't know if it's known for RPGs, but there are a lot of fucking good RPGs on it.
Well, definitely, the GBA is cracking for RPGs. Like, it was the first time you could really have such a big, long RPG adventure, but just play it in the car, on your couch or that, you know, and...
You know, I don't know if you've done this, but I've got a list of games of potential Neddy picks. You know, if something pops into your head and you go, oh, it would be good if Andy Mack played Soul Blade on the podcast. I'll take a note of that on my phone. A couple of GBA ones. I've been toying with the idea of getting Andy on Golden Sun. That's just a banger. I think you might like that.
Oh, I was going to dock some, couldn't I?
McCormick. I don't know if you've actually played it already, but Mega Man Battle Network...
I played it a long, long time ago, but I'm going to pretend I didn't.
It seems like a McCormick game. It's on my list under your name.
I think when it was just first announced, like, there's Mega Man, it's an RPG, I'm like, right, take my money.
Aye.
There was a wee guy who was a virgin up until the age of like 30 in our class, in our school, sorry, that had Golden Sun, and he used to talk quite a lot about it. His name rhymes with...
Just say the name, I can bleep it. Right, okay. Oh, he was a Golden Sun fan.
Aye, he used to come in and sing its praises, aye.
There you go.
Aye. So there you go, there's a fucking hardcore gold piece of knowledge for you.
I know, I was really needing to hold back for further doxing there and talk more about this man, but I'll be merciful and leave him off it. Alright, do you know what? I'll come in and give you my second roastie as well, okay?
Okay.
It is Romancing Saga 3.
Brilliant.
Also, late in the year, I had to have the absolute boy, Akitoshi Kawazu, on here, man. I think I probably mentioned on the episode that I had attempted to play this one as a teenager and kind of never really got it. I never understood what you were meant to do. So it was a nice experience to come back to something and for it to finally click, do you know what I mean? To finally get it and to get a good chunk of time into it. I was most blown away on this one by how different your story could be from somebody else playing the game. Do you know, a lot of these SNES role-playing games, I mean, like Tales of Phantasia, for instance, you're going to have the same story play out as everybody else. They're very linear, they're kind of on rails. Not a bad thing, I love it as a genre. Romance and Saga 3 had all this mad, unique shit that could happen in it, just based on how you did things and who was with you at the time. Like the fucking God bless a snowman. Like, that's a moment in gaming that's going to stick with me. I had this snowman party member, I talked about it a lot on the episode, that like sacrificed his life to beat like one of the big bosses. But that doesn't happen for every player. If that was a Final Fantasy game, that would be, you know, fucking pointed at as this fucking amazing moment. But not everybody, like only like 5% of the people that play this game are going to see that.
It's really impressive. And you said it was like ahead of its time, and it was also, I suppose, ahead of its time for you playing it. You weren't at the right point in your life to play it. It's quite cool to find out that you've grown into it almost. And yeah, definitely wasn't the sort of playground that we went to as kids, but you can imagine folk just talking about this. Like, well, I've been cutting about with a party member that's got lit. A snowman and a magic lassie that I found in a dream, and you're like, well, I've got an old man and a humanoid crab, and I went on an adventure with them. It's like you could be playing two completely different games.
If you see that in school, you'd have your head in the toilet and a fucking changing room, man. Can't tell
at you. This was actually on an episode that Andy missed out on. This was when Leo subbed in for you and played Tough Man Contest, the Butterbean game. So you might be freshly listening to chat about Romance and Saga 3, although you probably did listen to the episode.
Of course I did. I was the biggest fan there. That was the only thing keeping me sane, man. Fucking hell.
I'm going to try and play a couple of these if I can pull myself away from Baldur's Gate 3 at any point. I would like to play maybe Unlimited Saga or Saga Frontier 1 or 2. I've kind of heard good things about them. Saga Frontier being on the PS1, that's kind of prime RPG era for me. That one brings back some of the weird things you got from the Game Boy games, actually, where like you've got a party member of robots and mutants, and they all get different mechanics and that.
We'll get one of the Game Boy games on, I think, just because that's... When I think about our Gorbals flat, like, one of the prominent memories that sticks out is playing through Final Fantasy Legend on the Game Boy. It was such good crack.
Well, I never played 2 or 3, but I suppose also, like any other RPG, if they're one of his guests, could well have the first one that we played.
Aye.
So when you just played Final Fantasy Legends on the GameCube, the Game Boy, we sort of hunched over on the wee screen, or was that an emulator?
It was we played it on either mine or McCormick's laptop. We were just sat on the couch fucking in front of a laptop watching all the mad shit you could do in this game, getting your monster to transform into different monsters and your mutants and fucking all the other crazy shit in it, man.
I think one is would be on the controls and the other one would have the FAQ up the
monster emotions. Right, now
you need to fight a dragon, now you need to fight a werewolf or something.
Aye.
Lads, those are the good times, man.
Aye, definitely. And Romance and Saga 3 definitely retains that fucking weirdness for the first one on the Game Boy. These Akitoshi Kawazu, man, fucking, he is not conventional. Like, there's something a wee bit fucking strange about these games, which might make them a good pick for Andy now, I think, on it. There you go, that's my second roasty. Andy, why don't you come in and give your second?
Alright, okie dokie now. I was torn. I have done mine in order this year, so this will be my second favourite.
Me too, actually. I've kind of gone bronze, silver, gold.
And this one was, I was reluctant to put this second, but it was difficult. It was a bit difficult. But I'm going to go with Dungeons and Dragons.
Aye.
The fighting game.
Shadows over Mystara, or whatever it was called. Aye. Shadow
I was pretty sure this is going to be somewhere on your list.
Aye.
Again, a fucking brilliant 2D beat 'em up in the vein of Golden Axe that we always talk about, or Streets of Rage, but refined to the point where it was well beyond any capabilities that any consoles had at the time. And really difficult, a challenge, and I like the fact that you, instead of just having different moves, you had different abilities, different magics, and you could go a wide range of characters who didn't always rely on strength at that RPG way of thinking, that the magic guy might be better against some baddies, whereas the warrior guy will be better against other baddies.
It's unusual to have a side-scrolling beat-em-up that's got support characters in it. That wouldn't be a thing. Like, if you were playing two-player Streets of Rage with somebody, it would be like if you if Skate like could heal Axel, do you know what I mean? You kept him out of the fighting and that he could do spells or something. You don't see that in side-scrollers. I think a lot of it was built for the four-player, you know, standing-up arcade experience.
Aye. It's interesting. When you play an arcade game, it's on Neddy, right? It's different because you're not playing with lives. You kind of die, essentially. You can just keep going and going and going and going and going. And it brings a sort of different thing to it. So I enjoyed this game with like a song or a painting or even a book or something. Well, I just enjoyed what was coming at me because I knew there was no danger. I wasn't going to die. I wanted to try and do it as less coins as possible, but I just enjoyed everything I had to offer. The colours, big fucking sprites.
Big sprites.
Tunes.
I mean, it was made... The 2D beat-em-up genre, which is probably... Would I be right in saying that's maybe your second favourite type of game, Andy?
Probably, I would say so.
This was made shortly before that kind of died off. Like... So this was very much a kind of height of that genre before it disappeared for a while. I mean, it's back now due to, you know, the nostalgia boom. They're making new Streets of Rage games.
Aye.
They're making new River City Ransom
Turtles.
Games. Turtles, there's a new Turtles game. So it's came back with a bang, but there was wilderness years there where this wasn't a fashionable type of game.
They've had to find a way to like make these games make sense on consoles and that, because I always felt like I wasn't really getting the full experience playing one of these things at home, like with lives and, you know, having folk run the system and that. Like, it's very different to playing something in the arcade. Like, some of the more modern ones, like they add in the odd different kind of progression mechanics and like maybe roguelite type things and that as well, to kind of make it so that it's not just you win by putting in the most 50p's.
Had this interesting aspect to it as well that was I seen before in the Death Adder game he's gave me, the Golden Axe Death Adder game. Alternate paths, so you could choose where you were going. You could play a different game essentially every time you were playing, which is cool.
This was that was the, I think I said in the episode, that was the thing that drew me most to it when I was a wee guy, because, you know, I think it might have, it was like 50p or a pound for a shot, which was an expensive arcade game for the time, because you would get ones that were 10 or 20p. I remember putting it in, and then I would go away from it thinking, what would have happened if I went the other way?
And then, that's I know, it just flings these wee things at you, and it's interesting, it mixes it up, and it also, it's the only beat-em-up I've ever played that had a hub world in it. Like an arcade game with a hub world. Alright, it was timed, but still... I mean, that's about as RPG as it's going to get in a arcade game.
Aye.
It was strange. Again, it's a wee bit like what I was talking about a previous game, where it's a mishmash of different genres. All right, it's dominantly a beat-em-up, but they're trying something different. They've not just made another Golden Axe or another Turtles or another Simpsons. They've done something completely different.
Much like Romance and Saga 3, interesting things always happen when you introduce a Japanese person to Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah.
And they have kind of, it's good that they've kind of given a note. They could have just made this a straight beat 'em up for a young American Wayne's that love fucking smashing cunt's heads in, just like their dads and their grandas. But this game here does have some stuff for the original Dungeons and Dragons game. Points matter, dice rolls.
If you're a D&D heed, there's a lot of good fan service in this. You know, you fight owlbears, displacer beasts, the beholder. We all like the beholder. You can fight a beholder in this.
I'm not a fan. He's a big guy, sucks your head, doesn't he?
He's a big eyeball. Aye. And it's got like kind of tentacle head to be like wee eyeballs. Oh, I love them.
I'm a fan of him, but I'm not a fan, if you know what I mean. He's a bogging bastard.
I do enjoy him. Another solid pick. I mean, we're into roasted territory. I don't think I'm going to be that surprised by the picks. But Mr. McCormick, why don't you come in with your number two?
So my second choice is the bonkers but incredible Mystical Ninja starring Goemon, also on the
NES.
Nice one.
This is maybe the most charmed I've been with a game since like Earthbound, like right from the get-go with that fucking mad theme song, which I wasn't expecting. Yeah, it was a great surprise. I come in not expecting anything, not knowing anything other than like what the main character looked like.
Aye.
And I found a game with just this kind of mad Japanese sense of humour, this very peculiar to us, but I mean, probably not to a Japanese person, like setting and aesthetic in gameplay that is like all your favourite N64 games in one, like Zelda and Mario 64, and even while it was a bit in those mad bits where you're in the robot.
There was a mech bit, wasn't there?
Aye, there's like a whole mech, absurdly complicated, involved mech minigame.
Aye.
That only lasts like a couple of minutes in the game, but seems to have as much effort spent on it as like the entire rest of the game put together. And I'm going to play my song card here because I played on the episode, I played the main theme of the game, but the giant robot also is a theme song, which I'm going to play. Gameplay, but with enough depth to kind of keep you interested. Didn't really outstay its welcome. I loved the wee sushi, humanoid sushi baddies. I thought they were just delightful.
This was an early in the year pick as well for you. I think this would have been January or February. And I sometimes feel like it's harder for the earlier in the year games to get on the dinner plate. Purely because you play things after them and they kind of overshadow them sometimes.
It's like the Oscars.
Aye,
it could be that. But I'm glad this one stood out to you because Mystical Ninja Goemon is an old blockbuster classic for me. It really stands out in the memory. And I always wanted to own it, but I never ever had a spare grand. So I could never get it. But it was one of them kind of mythical cartridges that was more than my life was worth. So I always loved it, and I'm glad you did too. I always used to love looking at it in my magazines. I had as well. I always thought it looked brilliant.
I think a game that can hold my attention long enough for me to actually complete it on the podcast is going to have some staying power in my head.
I think those ones need to be on the plate. I don't often beat games for this anymore. I don't know if that's a terrible to the listeners or whatever. But yeah, I don't complete them very often.
Yeah, and it wasn't a short game. It wasn't a long game either, but you know, not sure you can finish in an afternoon.
We're not reviewing the games, we're just playing them, and it could go either way, I suppose. I know what you're saying. If you complete a game, then you're really onto something, and you're really completed something that you enjoyed, and it's going to get a golden reception when the episode comes round. But I'm glad you picked this one, and two N64 games on your fucking plate, man. They're going to be big fucking polygonal fucking roasties with bad textures.
Oh.
I know, you're going to convert me. I'm going to start talking about fucking inaccurate 3D rendering and the technical shortcomings of the PlayStation.
I can hear him talking about loading screens already, for fuck's sake.
You'll not be able to see your living room door because of the fog.
Do you know what? I've not really had any opportunities to say this, but like, I'm never going to hate the PS1 because one thing I've discovered this year is a list of YouTube videos. They're not videos, they're mixes, basically DJ mixes, called PS1 Jungle, and it's basically examples of jungle drum and bass music on PS1 games. There's so many of them, I didn't realise how much fucking breakbeats that you could fit in on a PlayStation disc.
Going back to our potential games lists, Buck Bumble has often been on there just for the tune.
That's another one I've got for you, man. I'm going forward, because Mick's got one of them Steam Deck Kings. There's going to be a lot more than that N64 and Knuckles stuff, aye.
I mean, we both get Steam Decks now, so...
Aye.
Emulation stuff is, as I said, I don't think Mick's got the full emulation kind of suite set up, but once you do get it running, it's going to unlock a lot, I think.
Aye. And remember, man, this podcast has been going for 5 years now, which is fucking crazy to believe. So a lot of things that were only retro when we started will be retro now.
Yeah.
What, does PS3 count now? Is that...
Do you know what, man? It's getting to that point, man. I don't think it'd be sacrilege to the PS3 on this podcast.
Cast your mind back to, like, fucking Fallout 3. That feels old enough to me, and that's a PS3 game.
I think Ninja Gaiden on the PS3 is possibly a shout, just because there's something kind of old school about it.
PS3, man, I just can't. My brain's like, that's not compute, but I know it's true. I think I'm having a crisis, lads.
Some of the games I played this year, fucking Jet Set Radio Future, right? That Luigi's Mansion, like,
aye.
That's the same console generation,
isn't it?
Yeah, that's one you wouldn't find. Money wouldn't be considered retro when we started this show, I don't think.
Aye. Right, I'll come in with the first sprouter.
Let's have it.
It's probably not going to be a great surprise that I'm throwing it to Evil Dead, Hail to the King.
Not groovy, then?
No, it wasn't groovy. But also, I don't know if it's a truly terrible game, right? I'm going to be honest. I didn't have a great time with it. Other people might. I didn't have many really bad games this year. I don't think in any of our lists that there's an obvious, like, complete turd. This game, to me, felt a wee bit half-arsed. I thought the combat was boring and that there was too much of it. I didn't find it effective survival horror. I'm a bit of a survival horror heed. And when this was in the genre, I don't think it captured the spirit of those games very well. And I was also disappointed for the point of view of being a big fan of Evil Dead 2. I don't think its run out on console was very good.
Aye. Again, I think I picked it because horror ticked the box. It was a Halloween episode. And
yeah,
it was Resident Evil kind of vibe to it. So that plus that equals get it on Neddy.
I don't think it's necessarily a bad pick, because it's interesting to talk about that they made an Evil Dead game. So I don't begrudge you picking it for me, type thing. I just didn't have the best time with it, and if I look back over the course of the year and everything that I played, this is the one I had the worst time with. Aye. So for that reason, it sprouted up, man.
Fair fucks, man. Fair fucks.
Aye.
It's always a gamble turning a film into a game. I think they've only very recently, like, got the sort of game design toolkit to be able to make, like, a good adaptation of something like a horror comedy, for example. Like,
aye.
In the PS1, you're like, how are you even going to do that? I'm thinking about this because I just so recently played True Lies, which Jamie Lee Curtis was excised from. It's like, you're not getting the full True Lies experience by just having the shooter parts, you know, so
aye.
Making Evil Dead into a survival horror, I think, is missing something fundamental about Evil Dead.
I think sometimes when they really nail it, when you get a very good game, it's not always a good adaptation. I think GoldenEye is a fucking masterpiece of a game. Is it a great adaptation of the movie? Probably not. It's, the movie's almost incidental to it, other than some aesthetics, do you know what I mean?
Aye. You either have to go one way or the other, I think. You can't
half-ass it. Aye. But, aye, there you go. Bruce Campbell is on the plate with some Deadite gravy.
No.
There you go. Andy, why don't you come in with your sprout?
This has been difficult, man, because there's a couple here that didn't inspire me in the nicest possible way. I'm sitting here now, like, do I even want to fucking see this? Because I'm going to get slaughtered after thousands and thousands of listeners who support Nintendo. But I'm going to go with Kid Icarus.
Interesting.
I mentioned on that episode that it's something to do with... It came out at a time where I wasn't familiar with gaming, essentially, because I wasn't born. But 8-bit games...
I got the vibe that you maybe didn't have a great time playing this and that you were talking about it quite diplomatically.
Aye. Well, I was trying my best, but it was too hard, man, and it was too samey. I couldn't get to grips with just things coming at you for the sake of it. And the game deliberately just trying to be as unenjoyable as possible. And enjoyment's place was challenge. I mean, I think there's a whole genre called Dies in Maida. people really love it. I'm not getting on. Kaizo, is it?
Yes.
That people love that type of thing. I don't. I like to have clear blue water between me and my next enemy and
That's turned into an Eddieism, isn't it? I'm sure on an episode this year you referred to Kaizo games as Dyson games.
Aye. That proved me there was a lot of novel stuff in this game as well that perhaps wasn't refined yet, and it certainly shows. And it was just, I was having a difficult time in finding enjoyment in it.
Aye.
Even though I found it charming at times, and I could see that it was well made, a lot of the new stuff at the time, novel stuff to do with platformers and shoot 'em ups and stuff, running guns, just wasn't there yet, and it made it really just a slog for me to play.
Like myself, you've looked at your list that you had this year and thought, what physically, when I was sitting playing it, the reality of it, what did I have the worst time with? And it's this, isn't it?
Aye, I'd say so. I mean, I'm not going to lie, Pandemonium was a fucking messy game. and Decap Attack was a bit meh. Aye, this one stands out as one where I didn't have a great time.
Aye.
But I'm sure this is going to piss somebody off somewhere. But all I can say is I just didn't get it. And I could see that it wasn't a bad game objectively, but in my subjective wee ontological experience, I didn't have a great time.
McCormick, what's your sprout?
So, in a year where we've seen the passing of a beloved monarch, maybe not by us, no, but a lot of people did love her, and we've seen that crown pass from somebody who a lot of folk had a lot of respect for, and she maybe like represented a time of, you know, pride for this country, to her son, who's much less beloved and overall much more controversial figure.
Yes.
It's become very difficult to be a defender of the crown. So I was a bit loath to give this game my sprouter, because I'm trying to be charitable with games that are, like, as Andy was saying with Kid Icarus, before our time, in where a lot of the conventions, things we've taken for granted in games, hadn't really matured and evolved yet. But again, from like a purely objective experience, which game did I have the worst physical time playing? It would have been Defender of the Crown, unfortunately.
Also, like, look, you had a good year, Mick, right? I think we've discussed this. You had a lot of bangers this year. I don't really know that you had a bad game. I don't think this is a bad game, but I can absolutely see it being a chore.
Yeah, it's a bit janky. It's a bit, I would say, a bit opaque. Like, in terms of the strategy elements, like, that, it's very difficult to kind of get my head around what was going on, like whether or not I was going to beat a particular battle scene, for example. And then when I tried to get by on just the action sections of the game, those were just quite primitive in a way that, like, a more modern game might be I may have an easier time with, like trying to master all the mini games and stuff.
Aye.
I've had the RSPCA at my door a couple of times due to the number of horses I've killed or at least maimed in this game. That took a toll on my soul.
I know sometimes we talk about, you know, this game's for babies and part of like that, talking about things being too easy or whatever. This game is fucking inscrutable at times. Like, you can fully lose this game in like 3 turns and not know what the fuck has happened.
In a matter of seconds. Like,
yeah.
And like, I think that's the kind of killer combination for me. And it comes up with games like of the kind of C64 era, where like the long and difficult and confusing, and like all those things kind of feed into one another. Like, I can handle one or even two of those things, but when it's all three, then you're just at that point having a bad time. And I think some folk, I think I was tempted to go for Fahrenheit, but I changed my mind quite quickly, because Fahrenheit is objectively fucking terrible, but in a way I got enjoyment out of it. I played it to the end, I had fun laughing at it. Like, I was having fun in a manner of speaking, playing it.
When I think back to Fahrenheit, I'm a bit of a fan of that game, actually. And I only really ever think about the setup. Like, it's got one of the best setups to a game I think I've ever played. That whole first section with the murder in the diner, and then covering it up, and then being the police investigating the murder that you've just covered up, was brilliant.
And then watching the game just, like, flush all that goodwill down the toilet.
Yeah.
Incredible.
it gets worse and worse and worse. It sort of spirals out of control. Yeah. But that brilliant intro sticks with me, so I can never truly hate Fahrenheit.
Yeah, I know. It's the bad movie. It's the bad movie effect. It's a bad movie in form. Yeah, apologies to Defender of the Crown. As I said, maybe a year of worse games. Probably would have picked something worse, but as it stands, you know, definitely innovative, definitely appreciate it. I like a mini game collection type game, you know. I like Pirates, Sid Meier's Pirates.
Yeah.
Which is kind of like mini games just flung together with a loose narrative. And, you know, you probably wouldn't have something like that without Defender of the Crown.
No.
So give credit where it's due, it's just not very fun to play.
No, I get it. Mike, if you want, you can give an honourable mention or two. And then gears your most succulent roast potato on your Christmas dinner plate.
So it's been a year of good games. I'm afraid there's been a couple that just kind of slightly missed the mark. One being Final Fantasy 3, and I was gutted not to be able to give a Final Fantasy game one of my top threes, because I love Final Fantasy and I've never really had a proper one on the list. But I don't know, maybe a wee bit too old and archaic to prevent me from having like the most amazing time with it.
I think that's fair. If it was 5 and it was the getting on your dinner plate, I would be affronted. I can see how 3 might be a just miss.
So 3 is missing all the charms are 4 and 5 then, 6.
I think it just hadn't quite found its feet yet as a series.
Aye.
Alright.
As Mick says, it's probably a wee bit archaic to go back to.
And Luigi's Mansion was pretty incredible as well. Jim, cheers for that one, Helen. But yeah, F-Zero would just kind of ace that one out, I think. But both great fun. Maybe if I'd spent a little bit longer on Luigi's Mansion, I didn't play it for as long. So, but I was just kind of starting to get right into it when I recorded the episode. But I think there's probably no doubt in people's minds, if you've listened to over the past year, that my top game is going to be Super Metroid.
I would have fully kicked off a riot if it wasn't, by the way. This is one of my favourite games ever as well. So I thought, surely this is going to be one of these roasties.
I thought of Goemon as like the surprise sleeper hit of the podcast, but like as soon as Mick said, I'm getting you Super Metroid, I was like, I'm going to love this, and I did.
Aye.
So,
one of the most acclaimed games of all time, critically acclaimed games of all time.
And Mick likes so many games that it's based on without having played it itself.
Ah, exactly. Yeah, big fan of Metroidvanias. This one is just a pure masterclass of design, like level design, world design, vibe, obviously, like that kind of dark sci-fi sort of vibe.
Aye.
It was impeccable. Even the little details, that like the little animals kicking about. Mick pointing out to me that like, that the only baddies start coming in once you've kicked off a kind of planetary defence system.
Aye.
You get scanned by a hing at the start. There are dead scientists on the fucking title screen of a Nintendo game. Aye. There's corpses. Like, it's very dark. I would consider it a horror game, actually.
So when you get scanned, it's not like it makes a big deal with it or anything.
Because I was like, what is the point of this? Like, I didn't actually realise what was going on, why that was like important, but yeah. Everything in this game has a purpose and a role.
It's got that thing that you boys love where, I mean, you get an opening text crawl in Super Metroid, but yous have got a big appreciation for, that I've come to really like as well, Sonic 3 and Knuckles style of storytelling. You don't need to put a single fucking word on screen and you know what's going on. Super Metroid is one of the best examples of this when you get the fucking baby Metroid larva coming back at the end and all this. It's fucking quality.
Aye.
And that's that was a big inspiration on one of my recent favourite games, which is Hyper Light Drifter, which technically has a story, but it's in like a mad archaic language that you have to translate with a guide. But that does your kind of wordless storytelling, I think, very well. Some games kind of forgot about for a while. Japanese games in particular, I think, started throwing like so many texts and tutorial stuff at you. Looking at you, fucking Wind Waker. But like any sort of melancholy, wordless story was chucked in the bin once voice acting became a thing. But yeah, this like you don't need any further. You don't need any lore. Like you get all your lore from just being in the world and like seeing it in action, like seeing what these space pirates are doing, seeing what these life forms are doing.
I like speculating. Like you know the likes. I've brought them up a few times on the episode, and subsequently when we did what characters would you go to the pub with, Craig, I often think, like, is he supposed to be intelligent? Like, do him and Ridley have chats and go, right, we are space pirates, what ship are we hitting next? Because they seem like mindless fucking monsters, do you know what I mean?
I know, what's the fucking, like, space pirate AGM like?
Aye. I was too busy just staring at these big space daddies, man. What a sprite that was.
He might be the biggest sprite of all.
Aye, a cracker.
You always love just the feeling of progression and getting more powerful in these kind of Metroidvanias. This one is kind of the template that all other games followed, but yeah, the kind of powers and the stuff you get access to are all pretty iconic, like the ice beam and the morph ball and all that, just kind of unlocking new ways through the world. And like, I like all these fucking nerdy game design, level design videos. There's a series called Boss Keys, which is all about, I think the first season was about specifically Zelda and like how the dungeons work, and then the second series was all about Metroidvanias and like how, talking about how the world kind of opens up as you collect more powers and things like that, and how, you know, some of these games have a kind of a linear structure, some of them go back in themselves, some of them have like a hub with like things that branch out for it.
Aye.
But Metroid, it does a lot of cool stuff with that. Like, there's that bit where you get a power up and then you fall down a big pit, and you're basically cut off for going back to the start like completely until you get another power up. So it's like the world isn't getting too big and too overwhelming. There's a whole section that you kind of get back to, but then you're always thinking in the back of your head, once I get back there though, there's places I can go, there's extra things I can see. So it's like clever things like that that just kind of keep making you want to explore and see new things. And like foreshadowing as well, like obviously that big horrible sort of dragon's head thing that you keep coming back to and seeing, you're like, eventually I'm going to get there. Eventually I'm going to see what's in there. Like that's,
you can access the kind of door to Ridley's lair quite early in the game. Like
ages
well
before you end up actually getting there.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's just good stuff. And I had a hunch that you were going to really like it, so I'm glad that it did make the impression that, you know, I figured that it would.
Aye, absolutely. I'm not sure if you've quite forgiven me for Tenchu yet, but I feel like this might go a little way to bring you back around.
I would still rate Tenchu as the most controversial Brussels sprout in Dynamite Nerdy history.
Aye, I'd agree with that. I concur.
I'll come in now, and I've got a quick honourable mention before I give you my most delectable roasty. I wanted to give a shout out to Monster World 4, which just missed out on a spot on the dinner plate. Very narrowly missed out. It was just a game that had a great wee vibe about it. A really sort of bright and cheerful experience. Fun to play, fucking bags of charm. In another year, you know, it would have been up there. Aye, it narrowly missed out. So I wanted to give a shout out to Monster World 4.
Beautiful. It was a beautiful wee game.
That's a cracker, man. As I say, another year it would have been up there. But the number one, my gold star for this year, the favourite game that I played, was Kirby Superstar.
Oh, yes. Yes.
I think just an all-round great package of a game. I was thinking about this when I was writing some quick notes, just topics that I wanted to cover about these games. I don't know if I've ever played a bad Kirby game. I don't know if they've ever made one.
I don't think they have. I don't think they have. The one I was going to give Patton, I think, is the most controversial one. But
I love Kirby Golf. I know he didn't have a great time with it, but I love Kirby Golf. But the thing I particularly loved about this game, I think you already know what's going to come out of my mouth, but it was one of the game modes called the Great Cave Offensive. And like Super Metroid, this is a search action game, or Metroidvania, if you fucking have to call it that. If you listen to that episode, you would know that I found that Kirby's skill set of picking up an enemy power and being able to discard that again and get another one was kind of uniquely suited to this exploration style of game. Like, getting the ability to breathe fire and realising that you could access a new area with it. Those kind of wee eureka moments that are like the fucking catnip of those search action games, this was fully it, with wee Kirby getting different powers.
What about a Kirby Metroidvania game?
That's what this is.
Oh, so it is, aye.
Aye, that's what I'm saying. That's why I loved it so much. I think Kirby is uniquely suited to that kind of Metroidvania style of a gameplay. Again, talking about the Brussels sprout and thinking what game I had the worst time with, I can't lie to myself. This is what I had the best time with. Like, on an intellectual level, I might like the RPGs more in some ways, but in terms of sitting in front of a telly, controller in hand, the most joy I got out of a game was kicking about as Kirby, exploring a fucking cave, getting access in different areas, and finding wee treasures. It was fucking cracker.
That's just something pure satisfying and moving it about as wee Kirby. And using all these different powers and that, like the kind of the way he can fly or kind of partially fly in that as well. And yeah, even like when he's got a sword or something, it feels quite just meaty to be kind of swinging around in that. It's cool that they've managed to get that he can do so much, but yeah, it all kind of, it never feels like unbalanced. It never feels like, oh, shouldn't he really be able to do this?
Kirby operates very well within defined parameters that you expect of Kirby. It never steps outside of that, and it never needs to, and they're always fucking good wee games. They might not all be amazing games, but as I was saying, I don't think I've ever played a bad Kirby.
I mean, it's pretty cool that, you know, the foundations are so solid that you can make a game which is basically just like, here are five different twists on this formula, and yeah, they all work somehow.
Yeah. Gourmet Race I wasn't a huge fan of, but hey, everything's got its fucking...
They had to throw in some daft minigames. Yeah. The ones where you're actually Dane Kirby things are all great.
Yeah, there's not a bad bit among them. But aye, that's my biggie for this year.
I didn't put a whole lot of thought into this one, to be perfectly honest. I'm not surprised that you liked it, but I was shocked that you liked it that much.
It was a backup pick.
Aye.
I can't remember what I was supposed to be playing, but
something that would have been worth it anyway.
It was something, I can't remember why. We had to fall back on this. I was like, basically you had to pick something else. It might have been due to like emulation failures.
Probably,
or
aye,
something along those lines. But aye, this was a backup pick, man, and it ended up being my fucking game of the year.
Aye, serendipity
though. Aye, Andy, saving the best till last year, pal. What you got? Honourable mentions if you want, and then come in with your tastiest roasty.
Honourable mentions. Well, obviously, I wee fucking Parappa, didn't I, this year?
You did, aye.
No, game, it's not without its flaws, but it's one of them games you've just got to love for everything
else it is. It's kind of broken. It's better than the sum of its parts, maybe.
Aye. And I mean, how could you say everything bad to say about that game? Come on, man. It's so much fun.
You like your karate on you, and you like your reggae frog.
One of my favourite characters in gaming in recent times, Parappa's Da, the gambler.
I'm so amazed at your love for Parappa's Da.
Fucking death of a salesman.
He's one of the most tragic figures. Like Bad Lieutenant or something.
Parappa! Hey, Parappa! Where are you going with my car? You've only had that license 10 minutes! Oh, Parappa, I still have 59 more monthly installments to pay. What am I going to tell your mother? I hope you're ready to pay for everything.
I'm in trouble now. How am I going to pay for this car?
He's always got a different game, a different universe.
Well, I know if somebody's going to play Parappa's Dad, definitely pick Harvey Keitel as number one. But
again, as we said in the episode, I think Parappa's Dad would commit suicide for the insurance money. I think he's a desperate character.
Aye, definitely. Other mentions, Doom, I suppose. Doom, very dated, but its legacy is so important, because without it, we wouldn't have same game after same game of first-person shooter in 2023.
Yes.
So, I'll shout out to Doom.
Dissing a whole genre here, man. No. Do you not like Half-Life? No.
Half-Life is good, but that's not just a straight FPS, is it? It's got other things in it.
Wouldn't have it without Doom.
Aye. I suppose I mean, this is why I'm picking it as a statement. And the biggest thing about Doom for me is it was the basis for the amazing Sonic fan game, Sonic Robo Blast 2, which is better than Doom.
I can hear the listeners dropping off. already. It's fine, it already counts as a listen. We're an hour and 20 minutes in.
So aye. So that's my one. Other one too. Nah, I'll leave it at. I was going to say Tombe, but second man is good. But
you want to talk about the speedrunner guy?
I still don't know if it was Tombe 1 or 2 that I played back in those days. I think I've possibly Mandela affected myself, because I was playing Tombe after I gave it to you and I was like, none of this is really ringing a bell. I'll need to find out what one it was I actually played as a child, because maybe I gave you the wrong one. I reverse Suikoden, because I know I gave Mick Suikoden 2 after I played the first one as a Wayne, but 2 is actually much better.
Aye. NBA Jam surprised me. I had a whole different game in my head to what it actually was. I thought, if you would have said to me, gave me this list of games in front of me here, and says, which guy's going to be on the plate, I would have said NBA Jam, but it really surprised me. It wasn't the game I thought it was.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes this happens as well, where NBA Jam is considered a classic. It's a lot of people's, you know, it would be a top 10 game for a lot of people, but sometimes it might not be what you thought it was.
Aye, and this is one of those examples. Maybe I had a great time playing it at one point, and no, it just doesn't stand the test of time, essentially, for me anyway, which I've been wrong before.
My hunch is, when I think back to NBA Jam and all the great times I've had with it, there's somebody sitting on the couch next to me and I'm playing it head-to-head with a pal. Do you know what I mean? Multiplayer. For that reason, I don't know how great of a single-player experience, particularly going back and playing it now, I don't know if it's the best single-player experience out there, do you know what I mean?
Aye, it's, I think there's something to be said for that. I was mostly single games growing up, so aye, this, I've never really had a shot as a two-player, maybe it would change my opinion, but yeah, I'm going to go for that as an honourable mention. Honourable. I'm going to, you know, Scotland qualified for the Euros this year. It was a great success under Stevie Clark. We're going to a country which happens to be the home country of the main character of my favourite game this year. We're going to Germany. And one of the most famous German video game characters is Wazza himself, Wario. And my favourite game this year is Wario Land 4.
I was thinking, who the fuck? when did we have a game about fucking the Red Baron? Johan Cruyff or something?
Oh, you were only on the pub chat fucking episode where we got into a whole thing about is Wario German? Because while you were thinking, who the fuck's German? I was playing the fucking Tony Soprano meme in my head of, I can't have this conversation again.
Aye. Wario Land 4. Aye, bordering on the very high level from which perfect platformers are plucked from.
Yes.
So it's certainly a contender for being very, very good to excellent.
I think when you're a platformer guy and you like a good cartoony platformer that's mechanically sound, you kinda do a lot better than Wario Land 4. It's very good.
I liked how he moved. I liked his special moves, and I liked how they felt in my home. I actually felt like I was controlling something on the screen rather than just things jumping about and like fucking clunkiness. I enjoyed the mechanic of you had to get all the keys and then make a mad dash back, and then the level kinda changed a wee bit.
Aye.
I liked the bosses. I liked how fun the bosses were. Kind of Sonic in vain, where they had a thing you had to work out and then exploit it. I enjoyed that. Also enjoyed the way the bosses looked, like the big flubber and all that, and the big things like that. It was a really good game. It was enjoyable. I liked the power-ups that you had to use to get onto the next part of the levels.
I like some of the weird examples of lateral thinking in Wario Land games, where sometimes like you need to get flattened to access some bits of the level.
Aye.
It's quite counterintuitive to let something like hit you, do you know what I mean?
Aye, like you got under the smaller bits, you had to get smacked in the head and all that. Mm-hmm. I like that. I mean, there's hundreds to tell you about this game. Alright, we did mention that sometimes it was a bit unintuitive in its level design, and that's a valid argument as far as I'm concerned. For instance, sometimes you'd be on a level for 8 minutes, and then sometimes you'd be on a level for fucking 60 minutes, try to figure out what you do, and the solution ends up something in the background that you've only got by process elimination. There was no actual logic on how to complete that part of the level.
Aye.
Got that a few times in it. If that wasn't in it, then you'd have a an ETG here, an all time great, and I really enjoyed this one.
Well, I mean, we're being, this is a very subjective thing, do you know what I mean? We're not doing the objective best games of the year, we're doing what brought you the most joy in the moment while you played it for this podcast.
I'd play this one again, and I'd sit down with it and try and pick it apart and all that, and oh, I can certainly see myself going back to this one. As you said earlier, if you find yourself completing, or almost completing, or even getting into a lot of stages of a game, then it's a success story on this podcast, because
aye,
usually we just fall out of ourselves and fucking throw our controllers against the wall. I'm not playing anymore.
I think there's something about Wario that kind of brings out just a pure element of creativity and fun in the folk making these games. You can get away with stuff with Wario that you probably can't with Mario or like most other Nintendo properties. This is kind of a theme that we've talked about like, oh, Nintendo, when they make this nowadays, like talking about F-Zero X and how it was kind of punk, and talking about how Metroid was pretty dark and all that. Like, you feel like they've maybe clamped down a bit on the ideas of like what their characters were, but we are maybe casting the sort of family-friendly Nintendo of nowadays back into the past. And in the past, they didn't quite, you know, have that same image. They had darkness, they had fun and anarchy and all these things.
I think this is the first instance where Nintendo made a game about one of their baddies. Because Wario first appears in Super Mario Land 2, 6 Golden Coins, which is one of, if not the best, Game Boy platformer, the original Game Boy for my money. Wario was the main boss in that. Instead of Bowser, you've got Wario, and that's his first appearance.
He's kind of like the Knuckles, isn't he? Well, he's bad, but he's...
No, but like, Knuckles is fucking, at his heart, a chivalrous character. Like, Knuckles doesn't have any evil in his heart, right? He's doing bad out of a sense of morality. He's been tricked, he's been brainwashed almost into being an antagonist. Wario is just a greedy arsehole. Like, he's just a prick. He's a baddie.
But Knuckles has suffered from flanderization, if you've heard of this concept, where, like, a character kind of becomes, like, mere caricature and mere two-dimensional over time. So, like, Ned Flanders was the example that kind of coined this, because, like, with Ned, he was, like, Homer's, you know, neighbour that was a bit annoying in that, but like his heart was in the right place, and you know, he was a Christian, but that wasn't the only thing about his character. Whereas like, as the Simpsons go on, it's just been about how he's a mad Christian, and that's the only thing. Like with Knuckles, he's now just a big daft bruiser and all that, and he's kind of lost any other character traits that he ever had. I think Wario's gone in the other direction, where he started off maybe as a very simple antagonist and has grown and developed and become quite multi-dimensional and obviously quite lovable, because people love fucking putting them in things.
There's the Wario GameCube game, Wario World, which I think is also a fucking bit of a hidden gem. That might even be a treasure game. But there are instances where Wario might not be a huge piece of shit. Like, sometimes he's been shown to maybe even have a wee shred of compassion, which really makes a fucking compelling character, do you know what I mean?
Aye. I like his, again, here comes him, the autism, but I like his purple and yellow aesthetic. It's got that kind of teletext thing, where two colours that shouldn't really go together, they go together. I quite like his design.
On Mario Kart, I will usually play as one of the wee random monsters, right? I like playing as, like, Dry Bones, or, like, Roy Cooper, or the Boo, the wee ghost guy. But if you're talking, going back to like Mario Kart 64, where they didn't have all the wee guys, I'm a Wario player. And if I'm playing like Mario Party, I like playing as Wario. For some reason, I like being him in these kind of party games.
He does a peace sign and he holds three fingers up and see the two. That's pretty funny.
That's a W.
He doesn't care about the room.
That's a W, so I just realised that.
He's got his whole fucking cast of spin-off like characters and his whole world and that.
I thought it was just a... I thought like, the three sign was just like a utilitarian version of the peace sign. But...
he is the most libertarian of all Nintendo characters.
He's fucking, he's basically Tony Blair, isn't he?
No, he's like Maggie Thatcher.
Maggie Thatcher, Ronald Reagan, he's one of them. Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Waluigi's Jacob Rees-Mogg.
I'm a big fan of Deep Space Nine, right? One of the great characters in Deep Space Nine is Quark, the bartender.
I like him.
Who's a Ferengi.
He's got a 50 pence piece.
Aye, but they're a race of wee horrible Thatcher bastards, right? I don't have to enjoy those characteristics in a real human to enjoy them in a fictional character, do you know what I mean? Like, a Quark episode is always good fun, but he's a slimy, greedy wee bastard.
Got it. Ian Duncan Smith. Isn't he? You take your sickness benefits away just to sit on them in a pyramid of coins.
I mean, whose favourite Nintendo character is Mario? Nacon, nobody likes this lawful, good, fucking boring, generic protagonist. But Wario, there's a bit of substance there.
I totally agree, man. And this is why he is my Uber Totty.
Aye.
Kind of Uber Smench Uber Totty. Then he landed it.
Meet you, your heart out.
But aye, I think good lists all round. I've enjoyed our wee round up here as per. I've been drinking my Christmas Baileys, and we'll hopefully have this up for the listeners to enjoy on that miserable last Friday before you knock off
for the
festivities. Aye, well, you'll have this to re-listen to, and you'll have forgot half the stupid shit that we've said, which is always a fun for a re-listen.
Drink enough Baileys, I certainly hope I will.
Another good year of Dynamite, Neddy. I've enjoyed that a lot. Thanks very much for being on the podcast with me.
Oh, magic is the same as every year, my man. We're going for, as I mentioned, 5 years now this year, and still enjoying it as much as I was in day one. I was a wee bit still coming off my Neddy phase 5 years ago, but here I stand now, 5 years later, still enjoying it, so thank you very much.
I'm in this for a long haul, right? I want to still be doing this when we're 80, right? It's never stopping.
Aye, I'm up for that, man. I'm up for that.
PlayStation 10 will be retro.
All that's left for me to say is, up the workers.
It doesn't matter, eat a chipolata.
Hardcore of the Merry Christmas.
See you later.